On July 26, 1863, in a rented house in Huntsville built to look like a riverboat, the largest life in Texas history came to an end. The state he had done more than any man to create had set him aside. And when they laid him in his grave, he was dressed in his Masonic apron.
Welcome to the Johnson City Lodge No. 561 Masonic History Feature. I'm Brother Archivist. My job is to guard the record, check the sources, and name what we can and cannot know for certain.
And I'm Brother Orator. I work to turn that record toward meaning, context, and memorable Masonic education. Together, we want to help brethren, prospects, and Texas history listeners learn Masonic history with curiosity, care, and source humility.
This Masonic historian agent was built by Dr. William Fisher, a Master Mason and proud member of Johnson City Lodge No. 561, to help share careful, engaging knowledge about Masonic history. You can learn more at johnsoncitylodge561.org or send questions and source leads to jclodge561@gmail.com.
This week, we mark the death of Brother Sam Houston, and we'll look at the whole of an incredible, contradictory man and how Masonic memory holds him.
To understand Houston, you have to start with a pattern in his life. He was always joining sworn families. He was born in Virginia in 1793, but as a boy in Tennessee, he ran off to live with the Cherokee. They didn't just host him. Chief Ulutika's band adopted him, giving him the name Colone, the Raven.
And when he returned to Nashville and began his political rise, he became prominent in the Masonic lodges there. A wife's family, an adopted nation, a lodge of brothers. None of these were his by birth. He chose his kin, and he chose them by taking an oath.
That choice would define the great crisis of his life. But first, he had to be ruined. In 1829, he was 35 and the governor of Tennessee. He married a young woman named Eliza Allen. Just 11 weeks later, the marriage collapsed, for reasons neither of them ever explained.
The scandal was total. He resigned the governorship and fled west, back to the Cherokee. The family that had taken him in once took him in again. Those were dark years. The record shows he earned the nickname Big Drunk. By any measure, the man was finished.
And yet, everything we remember him for hadn't happened yet. He was only 36.
That ruin taught him something essential. The man who crossed into Texas had already lost everything a man could lose in public life, and he had survived. That's the kind of man who can lead a strategic retreat for weeks, absorbing the anger of his own men, waiting for the one perfect moment to risk it all.
That moment came at San Jacinto on April 21, 1836. The battle was a decisive victory. Houston took a rifle ball to the ankle, and Santa Ana was captured the next day.
And then came the act that shows the man he had become. His army was screaming for a hanging, but Houston kept his prisoner alive. He understood that a dead tyrant was just vengeance. A live one could sign a treaty recognizing the Republic of Texas. Mercy, held under immense pressure, turned a battle into a nation.
Texas made him its first president that fall. And in between his terms as president, he performed what might be his most Masonic act. In December 1837, delegates from the Republic's three lodges met in the city of Houston to form a Grand Lodge for Texas.
And who presided over that convention? The sitting president of the Republic, Sam Houston himself. Think about what that meant. The Republic was a brand new country with almost no institutions. There were no banks, no public schools, and people were arriving from all over.
The record suggests that while Masons were a tiny fraction of the population, they held a vast majority of the Republic's high offices. Every president, vice president, and secretary of state was a brother.
That isn't about hoarding power. It's about manufacturing trust. On a frontier, the lodge was a credential that traveled. A man who could prove he was a Mason had a known character and sworn obligations. When Houston lent the presidency to that founding convention, he was building the Republic's first real piece of civic infrastructure.
The later chapters of his life were shaped by his wife, Margaret Lee. She was a devout Baptist, and the historical record is clear that she brought a new stability to his life, especially curbing the drinking that had nearly destroyed him before. In 1854, after her patient influence, he joined the Baptist Church.
The man who had spent a lifetime swearing himself into families had finally been fully claimed by one. And that matters, because the Houston who faced the crisis of 1861 was not the wild young man of 1829. His obligations had been settled into something like a coherent soul.
Then came the test. In 1861, Texas seceded from the Union. The secession convention demanded that Governor Houston swear a new oath of loyalty to the Confederacy. He refused. On March 16th, his office was declared vacant.
And this is where a Mason needs to pay close attention. He didn't refuse because oaths were trivial to him. He refused because they were everything. He had already sworn an oath to the Constitution of the United States and to the Constitution of Texas. He would not stack a new oath on top of old ones, it would break.
Then came a second refusal, which was perhaps even greater. President Lincoln reportedly offered him federal troops, twice, to keep him in office and hold Texas in the Union.
And Houston turned him down. He refused to buy his office back with the blood of Texans. Twice in 1 week, the most powerful man in Texas history laid power down. The first refusal was an act of conscience. The second was an act of love.
2 years later, he was dead in a steamboat house. Tradition holds that his last thoughts were of Texas and of Margaret.
It's easy to cast a man like that in bronze and be done with him, but we shouldn't. He was heroic and vain, merciful and calculating. He was a slaveholder who defied the Confederacy, a wreck who rebuilt himself, a father of a nation who died in a rented room. Masonic memory is built for exactly such a man.
The Lodge doesn't carve statues. It records a brother, initiated, obligated, laboring, imperfect, and present. It lets the whole record speak.
On the level, the contradictions and the glories stand in the same room, just as they did in the man. When Johnson City Lodge No. 561 received its charter in 1882, it came from the Grand Lodge he helped found. Every time we meet, we sit at the far end of Sam Houston's long road. Thank you for joining us.